This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years of craftsmanship, April 3rd through 30th. For a store location near you, you can visit www.peets.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
Good morning, it's Wednesday, April 19th, 2006, and this is the KABU Morning News. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Coming up on this program, Center for Disease Control officials have downplayed the risk of bird flu poses on humans. An American Medical Association study finds that consolidation of health care insurers is creating near monopolies in nearly all the U.S., and Bush has again said that all options are on the table in dealing with Iran. Weather for today calls for sun, partly, with highs near 70s.
Susan Enfield, Portland Public Schools' top administrator for curriculum and teacher training, said Friday that she will leave at the end of June after 20 months on the job. Enfield arrived in Portland in November of 2004 to head the Office of Teaching and Learning, the central office department most directly tied to student achievement. Superintendent Vicki Phillips recruited her from Pennsylvania, where the two had worked together. Enfield said she's leaving for personal and professional reasons, but declined to offer details. Enfield's department oversees teacher training, special education, ESL, talented and gifted programs, and curriculum and instruction at all grade levels. The hiring of Enfield and other administrators in her department brought more central office supervision of curriculum and teacher training, positions that had been cut to save money. Among other changes, the office has helped spearhead anchor assignments, district-wide writing lessons that have proved controversial with teachers. It is also helping drive a kindergarten literacy program and to work with Phillips on a new, more core curriculum. This from the Oregonian.
Every state in the nation takes advantage of a loophole in the law's requirement that students of all races must show progress. In Washington State, if your school has fewer than 30 students in any ethnic group, their scores are not reported separately, but just rolled into the school's average. Nationwide, nearly half of the 150,000 American Indian test scores aren't reported at a school level, the most left out among any racial group. This helps many schools, since Indians traditionally haven't performed as well on standardized tests as whites. Even if one small group doesn't make adequate progress, an entire school can face penalties ranging from a revised curriculum to outright closure. In Washington, nearly two-thirds of Indian scores aren't reported at the school level. Under the law championed by President Bush, all students must achieve proficiency in reading and math by 2014. Schools receiving federal aid also must demonstrate that students in all racial categories are meeting performance goals or risk penalties.
Lake Oswego is considering banning garden products containing chemical phosphorus, which would be the first ever ban of its kind in the state. Lake Oswego City Council is concerned the chemical runoff from such products are fueling the growth of algae in Lake Oswego Lake. Councilors will discuss a ban in coming months.
The Willamette River is the third most endangered river in the country because of its continued industrial pollution, according to a prominent conservation group. American Rivers named the Pajaro River in California, the Upper Yellowstone River in Montana, and Oregon's Willamette River the most endangered in its annual report. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality says it is seeking funding to better identify sources of toxic releases in the water.
federal lawsuit has been filed in Delaware alleging that drinking water supplies near a DuPont facility in New Jersey have been contaminated with chemicals. The contamination allegedly includes a suspected carcinogen used in the production of Teflon. The lawsuit says the contamination is linked to the manufacturing, use, and disposal of chemicals at DuPont's Chambers Work plant in Salem County, New Jersey. The plaintiffs are seeking class action status and compensatory and punitive damages. Delaware-based DuPont released a statement saying the lawsuit is without merit. In 2004, DuPont agreed to pay as much as $343 million to settle a similar class action lawsuit filed by Ohio and West Virginia residents.
Lobster men have reached a settlement with the final chemical company targeted by a lawsuit that claimed a pesticide may have contributed to a steep decline in the lobster population. Due to the lobster deaths, 75% of full-time lobstermen in Long Island Sound are out of the trade. Lobster catches in the Sound, which separate Connecticut and New York's Long Island, have dropped to less than 1 million pounds a year, compared with 6 million pounds in the late 1990s. Lawsuits filed in 2000 targeted the makers of chemicals sprayed in and around the New York area in 1999 to combat an outbreak of the West Nile virus. Suits against two companies were settled in 2004. Chiminova agreed to pay $12.5 million to the lobstermen. The settlement is in addition to the $3.75 million paid in 2004 agreements with Clark Mosquito Control Product Incorporated and Agrivo Environmental Health Incorporated. Chiminova admitted to no wrongdoing in the settlement. Company attorney Christopher Kelly and a company spokesman did not immediately return calls seeking comment.
Alabama has finally voted to pardon those who protested against race segregation 50 years after Rosa Parks refused to give up her bus seat to a white man. Hundreds of people got arrest records in Alabama during the civil rights struggle, galvanized by Ms. Parks' act of defiance in Montgomery in 1955. The Rosa Parks Act let survivors or relatives purge their records of crimes related to opposing racial segregation. Some criticized the law, saying mostly African-American civil rights protesters committed no crimes and needed no pardons. But many of the protesters had criminal records that haunted them for years and kept them from some jobs.
Two sheriff's deputies were charged with second-degree murder in the death of an inmate during a struggle over a mop handle. Ronald Eugene Parker and Brandon Gray Huey were charged yesterday and released on $25,000 bond. If convicted, they could face sentences between almost 8 years to 40 years in jail. Carlos Claros Castro, a 28-year-old Honduran immigrant, was arrested January 6th on charges of multiple driving offenses. The Davidson County Sheriff's Office has said that the next day, Claros Castro was threatening people with a fiberglass mop handle, so deputies went to his cell to disarm him. Claros Castro died during a fight over the mop handle, and two autopsies declared his death a homicide. The autopsies found that Claros Castro died from injuries, including asphyxiation and blunt trauma to the head.
State environmental officials might loosen emission restrictions on large industrial facilities in Salem because smog levels have stabilized. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. Smog, also known as ozone, occurs when volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxides combine with the oxygen. The pollutants come from vehicles, small engines such as lawnmowers, paints, dry cleaners, open burning, and industrial sources. Salem's ozone levels never have exceeded the federal 8-hour standard. The most recent violation of the 1-hour ozone standard, a more lax one that ceased to be used last year, was in 1996. The agency proposes changing some of the rules for industrial facilities, which would relax the standards for their pollution control equipment. It would affect about 6 facilities in the Salem area, including the garbage incinerator in Brooks. Some of the best programs for smog reduction in Salem actually occurred in Portland. Portland drivers have to get their emissions tested every time their vehicle registration is up for renewal, for example.
As part of his health care workforce initiative, Governor Ted Kulongoski and others are announcing the launch of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. The institute is a new private-public model to address the healthcare worker shortage in Oregon and to improve the delivery of healthcare services to Oregonians. We will be joined by representatives of the, or he will be joined by representatives of the Institute's partners, including the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, Kaiser Permanente, Providence Health System, Oregon Health and Science University, the Oregon Department of Community College and Workforce Development, the Oregon Center for Nursing, and other healthcare and education professionals. What actual effect the governor's efforts will have on the healthcare delivery system in Oregon is debatable. Real and immediate needs have yet to be addressed.
According to a recent study by the American Medical Association, the AMA, consolidation among healthcare insurers is creating near monopolies in virtually all reaches of the United States. Data from the American Medical Association report shows that in each of the 43 states, a handful of top insurers have gained such a stronghold that their markets are considered highly concentrated under U.S. Department of Justice guidelines, often far exceeding the thresholds that trigger antitrust concerns. The study also shows that in 166 of 294 metropolitan areas, or 56%, a single insurer controls more than half the business in healthcare, in health maintenance organizations and preferred provider network underwriting. The AMA study cited a Justice Department benchmark in citing antitrust concerns, the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, or HHI. A score above 1,000 shows moderate concentration, though scoring above 1,800 yield a high concentration. Figures show that 95% of the 294 HMO and PPO metropolitan market studies were above 1,800. The AMA study is the latest piece of evidence and most comprehensive to date, showing the market power of a few companies. The AMA says it has taken up this antitrust issue with the Department of Justice, but says it has run into roadblocks with regulators. AMA officials say regulators seem uninterested, even though government officials are more than willing to target doctors' groups and hospitals on antitrust matters.
According to News Tribune, federal health officials at a meeting in Tacoma downplayed the risk of bird flu, or the risk bird flu or H5N1 poses to humans, contrasting earlier warnings from the federal government. Dr. Julie Gerberding, head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, said that there is no evidence avian flu will be the next pandemic. There is no evidence it is evolving in a direction that is becoming more transmissible to people. Gerberding spoke at the Greater Tacoma Convention and Trade Center at a pandemic flu conference. She was joined by officials from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and elsewhere. Gerberding's comments on bird flu contrast earlier statements from the federal government that tended to emphasize worst-case scenarios. In one instance, in a November letter to the public, Bush encouraged preparing ourselves, our nation, and our world to fight this potentially devastating outbreak of infectious disease. But Gerberding noted that the infected humans were in intense daily contact with sick flocks, often sharing the same living space. Richard Raymond, an undersecretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, said when the virus finally gets to the U.S., it will not signal the start of a pandemic or a threat to the food supply, adding that cooking meat to 160 degrees will destroy the virus, in addition to destroying salmonella, which sickens people more than H5N1 ever will, even if there is a pandemic. Gerberding cautioned that when H5N1 is detected in the United States, there will be a temptation for the press to make this into something it is not, and we will need to be responsible as journalists to prevent irrational panic.
A military judge yesterday allowed defense lawyers to call a general to testify at a court-martial in the Abu Ghraib prison's abuse scandal. But the judge barred the defense from summoning Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Major General Jeffrey Miller, the former commander of the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, would become the highest-ranking military officer to testify in the cases stemming from torture of inmates at Abu Ghraib in Iraq. at a pretrial hearing in the case of Army Sergeant Santos Cardona, a defense lawyer said Rumsfeld personally dispatched Miller to Abu Ghraib to review interrogation procedures as the U.S. military sought better intelligence from prisoners amid a growing insurgency in Iraq. The lawyer, Harvey Volzer, said Rumsfeld took a personal interest in individual interrogations of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, including the ones in which Cardona, a dog handler, is implicated. The Secretary of Defense had video teleconferences with civilian contractors who were conducting questioning of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, Volzer added.
President Bush said yet again Tuesday that all options are on the table to prevent Iran from developing atomic weapons, but said he will continue to focus on the international diplomatic option to persuade Tehran to drop its nuclear ambitions. Bush also said there should be a unified effort involving countries who recognize the danger of Iran having a nuclear weapon. And he noted that U.S. officials are working closely with nations such as Great Britain, France, and Germany on the issue. As Bush spoke, diplomats from six countries converged in Moscow to map out the next step toward solving the Iranian nuclear standoff. The United States and Britain say that if Iran does not comply with the UN Security Council's April 28 deadline to stop uranium enrichment, they will seek a resolution that would make the demand compulsory, but Russia and China remain wary of the sanctions.
And according to Ross Story, senior aides to leading Democratic members of Congress in both houses have indicated an uncertain approach to resolving the standoff over Iran's nuclear ambitions. The Democratic Party leaders have remained silent. Democratic insiders say they don't want to rush to judgment without getting the facts, but the issue has received scant attention from Democrats in Congress. Most Democratic offices declined to comment for the story, and there is no formal consensus among Democrats on Iran. One Democrat, Senator Joseph Lieberman, has endorsed the possibility of using airstrikes to delay Iran's nuclear program, though most are more vague, saying they won't take any options off the table. And they appear to be serious. Not even the Democrats' liberal heavyweight in the House, Nancy Pelosi, has ruled out the possibility of using nuclear weapons, keeping all options on the table. One veteran Democratic aide described Iran as the most urgent security problem in the Middle East, even more serious than Iraq. Not all Democrats are silent on Iran. Representative Jane Harman from California, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, speaking specifically about Iran to the Council of Foreign Relations in early April, Harman portrayed the U.S. intelligence on Iran as a potential minefield.
Only one major U.S. building project in Iraq is on schedule and within budget, and that is the massive new American embassy, this from the USA Today. The nearly $600 million facility is being built inside the heavily fortified green zone by 900 non-Iraqi foreign workers who are housed nearby and under the supervision of a Kuwaiti contractor. Construction materials have been stockpiled to avoid the dangers and delays on Iraq's roads. A State Department spokesman said they are confident the embassy will be completed according to schedule by June 2007 and on budget. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for major projects serving Iraqis outside the Green Zone. The Senate report said many, including health clinics, water treatment facilities, and electrical plants, have had to be scaled back or in some cases eliminated because of the rising costs of securing work sites and workers. The report finds that no large-scale U.S.-funded construction program in Iraq has yet made its schedule or budget. The massive new embassy being built on the banks of the Tigris River is designed to be entirely self-sufficient and won't be dependent on Iraq's unreliable public utilities. The 104-acre complex, the size of about 80 football fields, will include two office buildings, one of them designed for future use as a school, six apartment buildings, a gym, a pool, a food court, and its own power generation and water treatment plants. The average Baghdad home has electricity only 4 hours a day and no clean water.
Iraqi soldiers manned checkpoints and searched cars today in the Sunni Arab district of northern Baghdad after 2 days of clashes that erupted over rumors yesterday. Stores reopened today and life started to return to normal in the Azamiya district. Elsewhere in the capital, however, assailants went on a shooting rampage, gunning down at least 6 people in targeted killings. Masked gunmen took up positions on rooftops, firing at military vehicles, and gangs of armed men roamed from house to house, urging Sunni families to provide male members to help defend the neighborhood. Defenders included members of a neighborhood watch group formed after the February 22nd bombing of a Shiite shrine in Samarra. The bombing triggered reprisal attacks against Sunni mosques and clerics, raising the specter of an all-out sectarian war. Residents said several of the dead were members of the watch force. A leading Sunni cleric, Abdul Salam al-Kabasi, broadcast an appeal over a mosque loudspeaker urging Sunnis to resume normal lives.
British scientists are at odds with U.S. scientists over a controversial plan to work alongside oil companies to hunt for fossil fuel reserves in the Arctic. This from The Guardian. The U.S. Geological Survey is lining up a project with BP and Statoil to find oil and gas in the Arctic Ocean under the auspices of a flagship scientific initiative intended to tackle global warming. The head of the British Antarctic Survey has said he is very uncomfortable with the idea and has questioned its ethical and scientific justification. Tackling climate change and working out how it will affect the Arctic and Antarctic is a central theme of International Polar Year, IPY, a high-profile project to start next spring that involves thousands of scientists from 60 countries. The Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet, and last September saw the lowest extent of sea ice cover for more than a century. Scientists say the temperatures there could rise by a further 4 Celsius to 7 Celsius by 2100, and the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free in summer by 2060.
The Mexican government has condemned the harsh new immigration law passed in the state of Georgia. The Mexican presidential spokesman said the legislation discriminated against Mexicans and that the diplomats would monitor how it was applied. The law is to take effect next year and prevents undocumented immigrants from receiving many social services. It will also require police and employers to report undocumented workers to the Immigration Service. Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue, who signed the bill, said it was intended to ensure that everyone who lives in Georgia abides by the laws. The law will take effect in July of 2007 and will also impose prison terms for human trafficking and limit the services commercial companies can provide to undocumented immigrants.
The Israeli High Court of Justice will allow the completion of the separation wall surrounding Jerusalem. This from Haaretz. Yesterday, the court rejected petitions by Palestinians for injunctions to delay the completion of the fence near 6 Palestinian villages north of Jerusalem. Justices Aharon Barak, Miriam Naor, and Esther Hayut ruled that since Palestinians will no longer be restricted in their travel in the area, the state may now complete the fence. Separate roads for the Palestinians to travel on have been constructed in the area, and a new checkpoint for passage between the northern and southern parts of the West Bank has also been made available for Palestinian residents.
Jordan has accused Hamas activists of smuggling missiles and other weapons into the kingdom and said it was canceling a planned visit of the Palestinian foreign minister, the second diplomatic snub for the Hamas-led government in a week. Palestinian Foreign Minister Mahmoud Zahar's visit to Jordan, which was planned for today, had been put off until further notice. On Friday, Zahar went to Cairo, but the Egyptian foreign minister said he was too busy for a meeting. The Jordanian spokesman told the Associated Press that missiles, explosives, and automatic weapons were seized in the last couple of days and that Hamas activists had managed to smuggle them into the country and store them. He would not say whether the activists had been arrested, though. A spokesman for Hamas declined to comment on the remarks, saying he had not seen the Jordanian statement. Hamas officials have been flying around the Middle East to ask for aid. They are hoping for help to compensate for the U.S. and European Union decision to cut off funds to the Palestinians.
Four senior Hamas officials will appeal Israel's decision to revoke their Jerusalem residency rights, the Palestinian Justice Minister said today. Israel decided yesterday to strip three Hamas legislators and a cabinet minister of their Israeli-issued identity cards, which grant them permanent residency in Jerusalem and freedom of movement in Israel. The decision was an unprecedented punishment for the Hamas-led Palestinian government's refusal to denounce a suicide bombing by another militant group, Islamic Jihad. Palestinian Justice Minister Ahmed Khaldi said that the Hamas government would back the lawmakers' appeal to Israel's Supreme Court, in part because of Palestinian concerns that Israel was trying to establish a precedent to strip more Jerusalem Palestinians of their residency rights. Khaldi said he believed the four have a strong case, saying Israel cannot prove that they were involved in any action that violated the law. Israel's decision drew attention to the complicated legal standing of more than 200,000 Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, the sector Israel captured in the 1967 Mideast War and annexed to its capital.
Yahoo Incorporated turned over email information of one of its users to Chinese authorities, who used the data to jail the account holder on subversion charges, a rights group said today. It was the third time the U.S.-based internet company has been accused of helping to put a Chinese user in prison. Zhang Lishun was sentenced to 4 years in prison in November 2003 for posting internet articles calling for the overthrow of the Communist Party. Yahoo's Hong Kong unit gave authorities a draft email that had been saved on Zhang's account, according to Paris-based Reporters Without Borders. Entitled Declaration, the draft was similar to manuscripts called Freedom and Democracy Party Program and Declaration of Establishment. The documents were recovered from a computer and a floppy disk owned by two other activists. Yahoo has also been criticized by rights groups for providing information in the cases of Li Ji and Xi Tao.
According to The Guardian, a top Italian court today confirmed the slim electoral victory of center-left leader Romano Prodi over Premier Silvio Berlusconi. The reported confirmation by a top Italian court in Rome came after the review of some 5,200 ballots that were not immediately included in the overall count as the voting intentions were not clear. The court said an official announcement will be made later today.
And an Easter bunny in Florida was fired over the weekend for removing the head of his costume and insulting a customer. The man playing the bunny punched a customer when she got upset that the photo exhibit was closing in 10 minutes. Mall management issued an apology to parents and children. Golden, Colorado-based NOAA Programs Corporate, which contracted with the mall to run the photo set, fired the belligerent bunny and his handler on Monday. They have also been charged with battery and disturbing the peace. And that's the KBOO Morning News for Wednesday, April 19th, 2006. Weather for today calls for partly sunny skies with highs around 70. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.m. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Brian Smith. Our assistant producer is Chris Andre. Our engineer and KBOO Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Carlos Chavez.
And